Friday, April 12th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. It was nice and slow, with an assist from Tracy Chapman, who told the world about their commitment to the extremes of tempo.
Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Quick, quick, quick. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Quick, quick, quick. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick.
But not in Chechnya, they don't, because of a decree by the Ministry of Culture, quote, musical, vocal, and choreographic works will be limited to a tempo between 80 and 116 beats per minute, quote, to conform to the Chechen mentality and sense of rhythm. This ruling, which promises to depress all cardiovascular health in a country that will no longer benefit from the really challenging parts of Soul Cycle, means that certain songs will not be allowed. Too slow, Amy Winehouse.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no.
But also, Hotel California. And you can stab it with the steely knife of ministerial decree, but you just can't kill the beast of these overly peppy songs. At 123 beats per minute, that is outside the legally allowed speed limit, and you know what else is? Which you won't be able to do, given Chechnya's strongman ruler. Quote, we must bring to the people and to the future of our children the cultural heritage of the Chechen people. This includes the entire spectrum of moral and ethical standards for life of Chechens, said the ministry. Quote, barring musical culture from other peoples is inadmissible, so a stunning rebuke to cultural appropriation. That would make all of the musicians of the world happy, except for anyone who ever does a sample or is sampled, which I think includes every artist played in this segment. Interestingly, the dirge-like national anthem of Chechnya, which is part of Russia, is too slow to be legally played in Chechnya. To which I advise the Chechenians who are tasked with playing it to shake it off, to borrow a phrase, but not a rhythm. On the show today, part two of OTM and UNRWA, but first, Food Inc. 2 is the new documentary out today by Robert Kenna and Melissa Robledo. It continues the conversation about the food industry, marketing of foods, and profiles innovative farmers, food producers, workers, right activists. A little bit of Cory Booker, a little bit of John Tester. Food Inc. 2 is out in theaters today and available via video on demand, and its directors are up next. Controversial statement upcoming about foodies. You know the best part about being a foodie? It's the food. And you know the worst part? Well, I'm not going to say everything else. The restaurant experience is often really quite good, but so often it's not. Getting the reservation and then cramming into a cramped table and then paying, it's often very expensive. And here's this trend. You know, tile looks cool on the floor often and brick on the wall, but then when you combine that in a crowded restaurant, it is hard to enjoy dinner above the din. What about the cooking? What about the food? Well, I give you Cook Unity. It's the first chef-to-you service that delivers locally sourced meals from award-winning chefs right to your door every week. Choose between 4 and 16 meals. You can just give your life over to Cook Unity, or just pick and choose their delicious meals from award-winning chefs. A chef collective bringing exciting culinary talent straight to your table. It's sometimes hard to find out who are the up-and-coming chefs. Cook Unity has collected many of them, and they give you 7 different dietary preferences: vegan, paleo, pescatarian, gluten-free, and then you can tell them, I don't like soy, I don't like nuts, or can't have them, and you don't have them. They post the menus 2 weeks in advance. It's fun to go and look over the menu. I've been enjoying so many of the meals from Cook Unity. I had a Korean beef dish that was amazing. I had a quinoa and salmon with the string beans that was likewise amazing. Couldn't be easier to make. They don't give it to you frozen. They give it to you in packaging that could last in the fridge up to 7 days. I've tested them on that, and it has worked. It was delicious. So experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/thegist or enter code THEGIST before checkout for 50% off your first week. That is 50% off your first week by using the code THEGIST or going to cookunity.com/thegist. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
When the pandemic hit, the curtain was peeled back. There were whole crops being buried. At the same time, there were shortages in the supermarket.
But that's not the only problem.
Working in the fields, our work is essential, but we as people were treated as disposable.
How could I go to work for these billion-dollar companies and feed all these people, all to come home to hear my son's stomach growl?
They say sequels are rarely better than the original, but here's the thing about the new documentary, Food Inc. If things had gotten better, there wouldn't be a need for the documentary. It's about abuses and the kind of startling status quo in the American food industry. The directors of this new documentary, Robert Kenner and Melissa Robledo, join me now. Thanks for being on The Gist.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here, Mike.
So what is the update? What was the motivating force to say we have to do a new one of these?
You know, we really have, as documentary filmmakers, have no particular desire to do a remake. As a matter of fact, we sort of avoided it and cringed whenever it was suggested. But when the pandemic hit, it just sort of crystallized and brought into focus so many things that had gotten that much worse. I would say it wasn't the status quo. I would say things have really progressed to a very frightening place that was sort of became all the more apparent that this consolidated food system that's gotten all the more consolidated since our first project became a real danger, that the system is far more brittle than it's ever been, because we have very few companies that are controlling every aspect of our food system. And that, you know, like when one baby formula plant goes down, we don't have enough baby food to feed the babies in our country. Or when basically workers were being sent into plants, slaughterhouses, which were totally dangerous spots, and being told they were essential workers, and yet they had no choice whether to go there because they couldn't get unemployment, and they would have, you know, starved to death if they didn't have work. So they went into these plants and were in very, very dangerous situations. And ultimately, these companies were so powerful that they could issue the get the president to issue the Defense Production Act, which required, normally that was used to get companies to do what they didn't want to do. But in this case, it was getting companies to do what they wanted to do and then shield them from any liability.
Right, because Tyson Meats wanted to continue producing its meat. And the head of Tyson Meat, John Tyson, wrote an op-ed saying, if you don't let us do this, meat will disappear. So their workers go into their factories and it's an epicenter of outbreak during the pandemic. And you document this, you tell the story through, I think, a pretty sympathetic local sheriff who's this kind of, I think he calls himself at one point, he uses every food cliche to describe himself. You know, I'm just a meat and potatoes, salt of the earth, monosodium glutamate kind of guy.
When he orders his breakfast, everyone, it gets a big laugh in the theater when you see his breakfast come out there. That's
right, right. So it's like, this is, right, this is not Robert F. Kennedy's running mate, right? This is not someone who is all vegan. He just doesn't want the local processing plant, meat processing plant, to be an epicenter of the epidemic, and yet it was.
Right.
He didn't want his community decimated. And that happened because these people go home and get sick and get all their neighbors sick. And Waterloo gets hit really hard.
So my question is, that seems sui generis to the pandemic, to the that particular set of circumstances that we're going to let these workers or, you know, allow these workers to continue working, even though it's dangerous for the rest of us. I guess the resonance there is it's stark, it's shocking, it was such a mistake. And also it's more symbolic than anything of allowing big food producers to call the shots with public health as at best an afterthought.
Well, look what's happening today, Mike. We're 14-year-olds are going to the plants, being hired to work night shifts on the most dangerous equipment in these plants. And this is getting 14-year-olds to do that. I would say that's equally as shocking. And then changing the laws of the states to make that legal.
So that's not illegal to have a 14-year-old working in these poultry plants?
That's correct. These places are allowing, they're setting, changing laws to make this legal, and this is happening, and they're now justifying why this is acceptable because of the power of these meat companies. So I think it carries over into the present day, and it was just more visible and more apparent during the pandemic, but the answer is that's how it's being operated. And it continues to this day.
Is the attenuation of the food supply chain different in kind or of type than the supply chain when it comes to other things that we need, everything from microchips to cars?
Ultimately, I think food is a symbol for, you know, people like to, we saw in Food Inc. One that they're more sympathetic to seeing bigger stories because they care where their food comes from. But I do think it's symbolic of many other fields as well.
Because before you mentioned that this is a fact, that there are only two baby formula manufacturers. When one of the facilities are contaminated, we can't feed the babies. But most of the issues here are not a question of abundance or enough supply. It's overabundance. That is the issue, right?
Well, that was the most fascinating thing is like Mary Nessel, who's a food nutritionist, saying how, you know, ultimately we're talk about how we were supposed to consume approximately 2,000 calories per day per person. And yet the food industry creates 4,000 calories per day per person. So their challenge is how do they get us to eat more and more food? And they've figured out a great solution. This ultra processed food that they're making is ultimately, we're learning somewhat, if not totally, addictive. We are eating more and more and more of that food, and we aren't realizing that we're doing it. And in a study by the NIH, a scientist there didn't believe that ultra-processed food made us eat more. He thought it was the nutrients that go into it, the sugar, salt, and fat, that we already know is not good for us. But he figured out to have a study where he created equal amounts of sugar, salt, and fat in unprocessed food with the same amounts of sugar, salt, and fat in ultra-processed food. And we were consuming 500 calories more per day in the ultra-processed food.
Yeah, this is the researcher, the NIH researcher, Kevin Hall. And it's really interesting. And even the graphics that you show on screen help orient us, which is just that. Same amount of calories, same amount of everything. But one is, and I'm going to get to what we all mean by ultra processed food. One is in the stark form that you'd find in nature. So I think we've all heard that starches aren't good for us. So one would be a bunch of rice. And the other, the starches would come from things that are refined and stepped on and refined again. And just the processing, as Marion Nestle says, you would expect the difference to be 30 or 40 calorie difference, but our bodies just get tricked into things or don't understand what's going on, and they will eat 500 more calories and consider themselves satiated.
Marion was stunned by that amount. She said, you know, she's been at this for 40 something years or more. And she said that she's never seen that kind of amount. You know, normally it's that she says 30, 40 is a large amount. And to come out at 500, something's going on.
Yeah. So the question I have, this is a little bit of a cause and effect question. As presented in the movie, the food industry is producing 4,000 calories a day. So they have to figure out a way for us to eat that. And they invent ultra processed food, which tricks us or works with our body chemistry and brains into eating 500 more calories a day. So it's not the case that we invent Doritos and every company operating under capitalism just would love for demand to go up. So we create this delicious thing that causes demand to go up. And then when we count the calories that we've eaten, especially because to pick on Doritos, we love Doritos, it being a processed food. Turns out it's so many more calories than we need. You're saying it's a little bit different. The food supply, like real foods, were just, if you add up the calories, being twice as much as we needed. So they retro-engineered a way for us to have appetites that match their production?
I'm not sure that's the case. I think the case is actually that it's very cheap to produce ultra-processed foods. And the profits are very high for those cheap products. And so I think that it's easy to produce more of that. And if you can produce more of that, you want to sell more of it.
And it's like the, perhaps this dates me, but the old Bert Lahr commercial where they say, the kid says, I bet you can't eat just one. And that was, you know, ultimately you can't eat just one of these ultra processed foods. It makes you want to eat more and more of them. And these foods, as Melissa is saying, are very, very profitable, because they don't have to pay the farmer. They're paying less and less to the farmer. And it's more in the value added is in the ultra processing. So that's where these corporations are doing very well. But they're also making a food that you want to, your body is tricked into wanting to eat more and more of.
Oh, yeah. Those Lay's potato chip. But I did not know that Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion, did commercials. That's another thing that we can
get into. It's a great commercial. Got cut out, unfortunately, but it was really fun.
Oh, so it's you. What have you got there?
Lay's potato chips, Dad. Bet you can't eat one.
Well, of course I can. Now run along and do your lessons. Oliver, I'll have another.
Uh-uh, I said one.
So you did, didn't you? So you did.
I knew he couldn't do it.
And nobody else can. Lay's has the secret. A potato you can slice this thin makes a chip so crisp, so light you can eat a million of them.
The marketing of foods is really interesting because I know, for instance, in Canada, I can't believe I'm telling you this, you would know this, but fun children's cereal can't be marketed like a TV on animated TV shows. They can't become beloved characters. And is it Mexico? If there is a health warning on food, and the health warnings are pretty stark and no nonsense, there can also be a health claim. So if it is true that the food is like, you tell me what a health warning would be, they can't even write the word organic, whatever that means, on the packaging.
Yeah, like if you go down the middle aisles of our supermarkets, all these foods that are not healthy have all these health claims on them. As where the foods on the outer aisles, like broccoli, they don't have health claims on them. It's only the foods that are generally unhealthy that have them to a large extent. So in Mexico, if you have a certain amount of sugar, salt, and fat in your food, you cannot have a health claim on it. And I think, you know, and in where was it we were talking today? In one of the countries, you're not allowed to advertise to children between...
It's like 6 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get the night owl kids or the kids. Yeah. Maybe the kids working at that poultry plant.
Yeah, right. They're busy. Yeah. They listen to it as they're driving those machines.
But if it's the case that, and both could be true, but if it's the case, do you think it's the case that packaging and inducements and commercials are the main driver for eating unhealthily? Or as I concluded from your documentary, it's our body chemistry and sometimes the quirks of body chemistry that make us crave food that large agricultural corporations are putting together. Even absent the fun leprechaun or the rabbit or just the, you know, contains no trans fat claim, we'd still be eating just as much of it.
You know, it's. I think they all play into it. I certainly think the food itself is hard to stop eating. And if you have no idea of what it's doing to you, you'll just keep eating it. And I think it's attractive to children if you can get them to start eating it at a young age. You know, McDonald's put in those playgrounds so they can get kids to start eating when they're very young, and they develop a lifelong habit of wanting that food. So I think, you know, I think all that packaging, as you say, has an effect to get trained people to eat this food. And once you start eating it, you can't stop.
As to the definition of ultra processed food, I mean, it sounds bad, but speaking of, you know, packaging possibly being misleading, Adam Gopnik wrote an interesting article in The New Yorker, as he always does. And he notes there's no real definition. There's a vibes type definition. He says urge to eat only food our great grandmothers would recognize as food, which is one claim of people who are against ultra processed food. We may forget, too, that she, our great grandmothers, would have prized white pastry flour, which is chemically bleached flour that's been available since 1906, and oleomargarine and the hydrogenated oils like Crisco that became common soon after 1900. So there are so many foods that would qualify as processed or ultra processed food that have been part of our diet for well over a century. And those don't maybe feel weird or foreign or chemically to us.
Well, you know, listen, you know, pastas are processed food. Oil is processed food. So many of the foods we eat and for hundreds, if not thousands of years are processed. And there, that is not what we're talking about. I think Marion in the film describes corn on the cob as natural food. Corn in a can is processed food. A Dorito chip or a corn chip is an ultra processed food because it's made with ingredients we don't have at home on machines that we don't have in our homes, and probably with flavors that we don't have in our homes. So ultimately, that's a simplistic answer. I think the FDA, who is looking into possibly or hopefully putting front of package labeling, is trying to figure out what is the best way of defining what ultra processed is.
Often the ultra processed foods have no whole foods in them whatsoever. They're just entirely manufactured creations.
Fooding 2 is in theaters, on demand, on all your streaming services, and you go to fooding2.com to find out where. And the names of the filmmakers are Robert Kenner and Melissa Robledo. I want to thank you both so much for being on The Gist.
This was great, Mike. You were great.
And now the spiel. UNRWA is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and they face a conundrum. And by extension, so do the refugees of Gaza. Because members of UNRWA participated in the terrorist attacks of October 7th. Some instances of that participation were very well documented, others merely credibly alleged by Israel. UNRWA has come in for scrutiny and a suspension of funding by many of its largest donors, like the United States. And subsequent reports from Israel, less well documented than the literal picture of an UNRWA worker dragging the body of an Israeli, there are allegations that a large number of UNRWA employees are affiliates of Hamas or Islamic Jihad. Yesterday, this show played excerpts from the NPR program On the Media, casting doubt on evidence of UNRWA's involvement in October 7th. And I quoted a listener and journalist, arriving at the desired but unwarranted conclusion that there was no evidence that those incidents did happen. They did. Today, we'll play more excerpts from a follow-up interview On the Media conducted with essentially a spokesman for UNRWA, which painted the organization in the best possible light and didn't acknowledge any legitimate concerns or criticisms. But now we get to another podcast I want to play. This podcast is called What Matters Now. It's produced by the Times of Israel, which I find fair. It's a centrist news outlet in the context of Israel, which is to say they don't love Netanyahu, but they also don't question the premise that Israel has the right to exist and to defend its citizens from attack. The title of this episode was UNRWA's Problem Isn't the Terrorists in Its Ranks. And on it, Haviv Retegur, the Times' senior analyst, lays out his thesis. So, to remind you, from yesterday's episode, both OTM On the Media's host Michael Lowinger and his guest spoke of the right of return, which is the idea that all Palestinians displaced in 1948 and all their descendants should be able to go back and retake land and property and whatever they owned before the war against the establishment of Israel. I explained almost every Jewish Israeli sees the right of return as an impossible fantasy that would end Israel. Lowinger and his guests referred to and credited the right of return, but they didn't really define it as tantamount. It's not really strong enough as inextricably linked to the destruction of Israel as a Jewish state. Okay. But let me, or rather, let the What Matters Now podcast do the important work of laying out that UNRWA not just endorses, but is organized around the principle of the right of return. So here's a minute of this podcast talking about and making this point more forcefully than I ever could.
The great problem of UNRWA in Gaza is not that Hamas deeply infested that organization on the ground. And people who support the Palestinian cause, in some cases support Hamas outright, they say Israel needs to prove beyond any shadow of doubt for us that UNRWA employees took part in October 7, not just for Israel to be convinced, but forget the 12 or 13 UNRWA employees that Israel says took part in October 7. You literally can't get a job in UNRWA. Those 13,000 employees on the ground, most of them are teachers. You can't get a job at UNRWA, that guaranteed salary, that money, that massive, that well over $1 billion a year that UNRWA pumps into the Gazan economy. Hamas controls that. You can't get that job without Hamas approval. If Hamas doesn't want you to get that job and you take it anyway, you disappear. Hamas is not a liberal democracy, right? So Hamas controls anything of UNRWA it wants to control at any given time. And that is not something anyone serious has ever denied. You can't ever deny it.
So that is the problem with UNRWA, as per the What Matters Now pod. The problem isn't that some Hamas members are in its ranks, some terrorist supporters or sympathizers participated in October 7th, and the real problem isn't that there's just an obscure reference in UNRWA's documents about the right of return. The real problem with this relief agency, funded with $350 million U.S. dollars, $200 million German dollars, over $100 million EU dollars, is that the agency fundamentally believes in a concept that would negate peace, scotch any two-state solution, or really guarantee that if there is a one-state solution, if that were ever to happen, the one state would not be dedicated to the protection of the lives of Jews. Not only does UNRWA believe this, they propagate the ideology as part of their work. Here is how On the Media addressed that issue with Lex Tackenberg, their guest who was a veteran of UNRWA for 30 years.
Another long-standing critique of UNRWA is that its schools in the Gaza Strip, West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, are radicalizing Palestinian young people. Where does this narrative come from? Is there evidence for that?
That critique originates in a criticism of the textbooks that are being used in the UNRWA schools. In those schools, textbooks were used of the host countries, Egypt at a time and Jordan. And textbooks typically reflect the state of relations between the country in question and its neighbors. Israel discovered that in these textbooks there were elements of glorification of armed resistance and anti-Semitic tropes that they strongly objected to. They started demanding a censorship of those textbooks, and by extension said schools in which those textbooks are used teach hate. So it prompted UNRWA to set up in place an arrangement whereby all new textbooks that are coming up are sort of scrutinized. Any objectionable content is overridden with enrichment materials. But the issue of the textbooks has remained.
So did you hear his answer as I did? Roll it back if you didn't. Tackenberg was saying there that there was an issue with textbooks in the past, but the anti-Semitic content has been overridden. That was his word. And yet, even with these guardrails in place, people still complain about textbooks. Well, of course they do, because the textbooks to this day still contain a lot of troubling material. The U.S. General Accountability Office reports that, quote, prior to the release of the first set of Palestinian Authority textbooks developed by the Palestinian Authority in 2000, schools in Gaza used Egyptian textbooks and schools in the West Bank used Jordanian textbooks. So that's true 25 years ago. The textbooks that UNRWA has been using have been of their own design and not of that of neighboring countries for a quarter decade. The GAO, which is charged with assuring that the United States government and tax dollars are accountable, they reviewed UNRWA's textbooks to ensure that, quote, educational material taught in UNRWA schools is consistent with the values of human rights, dignity, and tolerance, and does not induce incitement. And the GAO found in its latest study just a couple of years ago that these textbooks fail on the criteria of dignity and not inducing incitement. In other words, they induce incitement. The EU did a large study of the textbooks. It was commissioned by the Leibniz Institute for Educational Media, which is the Council of Europe's textbook center. Just a textbook center. It got specific. They found that maps in UNRWA textbooks were irredentist. I love that word, though not the concept, noting that since they never showed Israel, that the imagined territorial entity of Palestine negates the existence of the state of Israel. They noted the frequent use of, quote, negative attributions in relation to the Jewish people in, for example, textbook exercises suggesting a conscious perpetuation of anti-Jewish prejudice. They found that these textbooks, quote, dehumanize and to a certain extent demonize Israeli actors. There are many examples. I can't possibly read them all. Here's a couple. This is from a religious lesson, quote, the text portrays the Jews as deceptive, cowardly, and aggressive protagonists. They attempt to kill Muhammad with a boulder from behind or by using poisoned food. Through the recurrent use of the phrase, the Jews, equally escalatory is the exercise asking about the role of Palestinian women in the face of the, quote, Jewish Zionistic occupation. Even if no explicit call to violence is present, it is clear that telling this story immediately before setting the exercise will influence the student's answer so that a violent solution to the conflict with the, quote, Jewish Zionist occupation might be suggested. They talk about this in the history lessons, one famous battle. The text portrays the Palestinians who took part in this battle as, quote, the champions who defeated the brutal Zionist soldiers who were trying to burn everything. The Israeli soldiers are depicted in the text as cowardly and thus inferior, such as, quote, burnt Zionist soldier held by thick chains inside his tank by his commander who feared that the soldier would otherwise flee. The text is accompanied by a drawing of a Palestinian fighter shooting at an Israeli tank with a Kalashnikov gun and hitting two Israeli soldiers. One of the Israeli soldiers has been hit, is hanging lifelessly over the machine gun of the tank turret. The other throws his arms up in the moment he is hit and loses his steel helmet. The review notes the violent use of firearms is glorified. In this textbook for eighth grade students, the wounding or even killing of the opponent is presented in a positive light. I could go on and on. Or if I were Michael Loewinger, I could just take Lex Tackenberg's answer and let it stand unchallenged. It's just the old textbooks with the old anti-Semitic part that's been overridden. By the way, let's acknowledge this. I've seen a lot worse in textbooks in the world, textbooks that they use in Iran, for instance. And the textbooks of UNRWA or the textbooks that are approved by UNRWA, they're improving. They are monitored. There's a process of changing pictures, changing phrasing. A jihadist fighter in past years who was once depicted as carrying a sword now just appears on a white steed. But it's not some settled complaint that's only unfairly used to criticize. The On the Media interview continues with the time-honored practice of playing for an interviewee outside critics' charge, so he or she may answer it directly. Here's that.
I want to play you a clip of UN Watch Executive Director Hillel Neuer testifying before U.S. Congress on January 30th in the lead up to the American defunding of UNRWA.
I've come here to ask the Congress of the United States to not just suspend, but to end the funding for good and to take the lead in dissolving an organization that is riddled with incitement to hate, involvement in terrorism, and the perpetuation of war.
Hillel is part of an outfit that is part of the Israeli public affairs machinery to deal with any systematic criticism of Israeli actions in the occupied territories. UN Watch make generic statements.
Indeed, a generic statement is what we just heard because it was the statement OTM chose to play. They could have played one of Noor's many specific charges, which we will play, but I did interrupt Hackenberg.
They have a track record of roaming the internet and finding objectionable social media posts. In some instances, have been posted by local UNRWA personnel, especially in the earlier war of 2014, when for the first time a war played out on social media. So at that time, UN Watch was sort of able to compile a couple of dozen screenshots of UNRWA teachers and a few other employees in Gaza and in the West Bank that had put objectionable content on their social media profile. And UN Watch continues to recycle that. They have even used these old screenshots in their recent reports.
So what UN Watch has is just a couple of decade-old screenshots. But in his congressional testimony, which there was a clip of about a minute after the clip that OTM did play, Noor testified.
Just in November, we sent a report on 20 teachers who celebrated the October 7th massacre. In March, together with Impact SC, we identified 133 UNRWA teachers and staff who promoted hate and violence in social media. In June 2022, we released a report called UNRWA's Teachers of Hate and included the following Facebook post by Elham Mansour, quote, an UNRWA teacher, quote, by Allah, anyone who can kill and slaughter any Zionist and Israeli criminal and doesn't do so doesn't deserve to live. Kill them and pursue them everywhere. They are the greatest enemy. All Israel deserves is death. This is an UNRWA teacher statement on Facebook. We sent it to the UN. They did nothing. We sent them reports in 2021, 2019, 2017, 2015, numerous reports.
So 133 members, just a tiny fraction of the overall organization. Absolutely true. What did they do? They celebrated Hamas attacks, which is not a great thing for an employee of a humanitarian relief organization to do. But they are Gazans and Palestinians, and they can't be expected to have attitudes so different from the population as a whole. They can be expected not to publicly post about it as representatives of a UN organization. But this did happen, and this did happen not in 2014, but in 2023. And it should have been acknowledged, not allowed to be inaccurately dismissed by the guest. If you wanted to steelman your position, you could quote not Hillel Noor saying something generic or even something specific, because UN Watch is easy to dismiss, I guess. Why not play Dennis Ross, Middle East envoy for Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Obama? He spoke at a UN Watch event, and he concluded,
UNRWA, if not by design, certainly by consequence, effectively was a vehicle for Hamas. One thing that should not be the case in the aftermath of this war is that UNRWA continues to play the role it did. Again, I'm not saying it should you go cold turkey, but you should create a transition away. Because what UNRWA is doing, if UNRWA maintains the same role, if UNRWA is given this kind of continuing responsibility, it will allow Hamas to come back in.
Put that critique to Hackenberg. Insist he engage on the basis of acknowledged truths, not the facile dodge of dismissing all complaints as invalid. Ask a real question, a challenging question. Don't accept dismissals of the premise. Here is a good question put to UN Watch's Hillel Noor by CNN's Jake Tapper.
Right now, they're in a crisis. You can't end, I mean, do you really think you could end UNRWA right now? Because, I mean, these people, like, literally, like, are dying of disease and malnutrition and hunger and...
Yeah. Well, of course, it's not going to end right now. And even the countries who suspended funding, some of it is performative. The funding was sent recently in Congress today. There were some congressmen who were upset that apparently the State Department just sent a ton of money before making that announcement. So UNRWA will be fine in the near term. And, of course, no one's saying in the near term abandon the Palestinians. But in the slightly more than near term. UNRWA is not the solution, it's the problem.
I don't know that I agree with Noor, but I would no more have him on as an expert to guide us through and provide context to UNRWA than I would Lex Tackenberg, who OTM did have on in that role. And if I did have Tackenberg on, I'd at least ask him legitimately tough questions and not accept the assertions that every critique of the organization is some sad, old, pathetic, out of date, based on a lack of evidence type criticism. I'm not even saying that it's a very difficult choice to defund UNRWA. We really are only talking about the sentiments of hundreds, the affiliation of thousands, and the horrible actions of a handful. But those things are real. Every other aid organization would come under legitimate scrutiny for them, and it is a choice to consider. An inaccurate description of the critics, that's all we got, that every criticism was illegitimate. And that's what Tackenberg offered. And that's what OTM accepted. I think that's what OTM expected. The show's listeners were left with this sentiment.
Israel seems to be intent on mass starvation as a further element in its ongoing genocide. We cannot interpret it in another way.
Don't worry. Michael Loewinger did not try. He just said,
Lex, thank you very much.
If this were a segment that I heard on Al Jazeera or even some BBC shows, it wouldn't necessarily raise my hackles. But it was an interview on the most prominent media watchdog show in public media. I worked there for a long time. The reason I'm talking about this is because I couldn't believe what I was hearing, but of course I could. For the show to be a fair presentation of the issue, it didn't have to conclude UNRWA is more bad than good. I don't make that conclusion. It had to present the question as something other than merely musty canards, pure warrantless smears. But that is how it was presented. So you've heard my objections. And I will add this. The most disturbing tactic to me was misleading the audience via the idioms and trappings of fair-minded inquiry. Truly fair minds should be disappointed. That's it for today's show. My producer is Corey Wara. My senior producer is Joel Patterson. And Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.